Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today's guest is Eddie Yoon. He has been a growth strategy expert for the last 20 years as a partner with the Cambridge Group, and in the last 5 years, he has helped double numerous businesses from cable media company, food brands, beverage companies, pet food brands, consumer robotics, standby generators, and more, from several hundred million to close to $1 billion. Eddie is also the author of the acclaimed book, Super Consumers, A Simple, Speedy, and Sustainable Path to Superior Growth, as well as the author of over 40 articles and publications like Harvard Business Review and many, many others. He has also been, excuse me, my voice is bad today, Eddie has also been a keynote speaker in the U.S., Africa, Australia, Denmark, the U.K., and Japan, and is now focused on helping business owners drive growth while maintaining a healthy balance between work and personal life. Welcome to the show, Eddie. It's good to have you here. And by the way, before I completely forget, thank you for the gift of the book that your publisher sent me. I don't think it's your publisher, your PR people.
Of course. No, I'm happy to be here, Denise. I'm really excited about this.
I have a lot of questions. I really do, because the super consumers, I can't wait to figure out what you mean by that. I think I know, but I have not yet read that book. I have the other book, which is called, so our audience knows, it's called Joy. And it says in the back, in a dull and dreary city, a man works day after day for the money he thinks will bring him joy. Then a strange yellow balloon begins to follow him everywhere he goes. Could it know where joy is found? And I know these are two completely different books, but I got such a kick when this package landed on my front porch. There was this book, there was a really nice note, and there was a giant yellow balloon. How happy was I? So thank you.
Of course, of course.
Okay. So listen, before we get, you know, too far into just kind of chatting, what is your book about? I wanted to start with that book because it sounds a lot of the questions I have are about consumers and consumer categories and category growths. And I'll be honest, some of it is a bit confusing to me. So I'm probably going to be asking questions that have you going, well, it's easy. No, it's not. So I need to know. So anyway, tell us a bit about the book and a bit about yourself, and then let's just go have fun.
Yeah. So the book, Super Consumers, was quite unexpected because I was not trained as a writer. And I think when I first started writing for HBR over a decade ago, I think my wife was like, you know, why are they having you write? I don't think you're a very good writer. So I was like, okay, well, that's a helpful vote of confidence there. But like the book is really about it's a little bit of a biography or autobiography of my career, which is to say I've been a growth strategy consultant for 20 years now. And any kind of, as you mentioned, Denise, any kind of consumer-facing company I've worked with. So companies, retail, consumer media, consumer technology, I've done it all with it. And I began to realize that a lot of the work that I was doing, you start to see patterns, and that sometimes the patterns were very simple in the sense that, you know, it just seemed like the answer was coming up to fit the pattern all the time in a way that I started to wonder, like, you know, do I really need to be doing what I do? Because maybe it's a lot simpler than I'm making it and stuff. And so, and the pattern that I saw was every category that I've ever encountered has a super consumer dynamic. So people know this as the 80-20 rule, the Pareto principle, but, you know, and that, so this is probably not a surprise to a lot of people, but that, you know, in general, within the grocery store, as an example, the top 10% of consumers who buy the most account for 30 to 70% of the category sales. So another way of saying it is that.
Oh, categories. Okay. Now you're getting to where I wanted to go. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. So take ice cream as an example. The top 10% of the people who buy ice cream account for somewhere between 30 to 70% of total ice cream sales, which is to say, you know, you might have people who, a lot of people eat ice cream. Some might eat ice cream once in a blue moon, and some might eat them on somewhat on the regular. And then I have another friend of mine, this another author, Taddy Hall, who eats ice cream for breakfast. He believes ice cream is the very best breakfast food out there. And, you know, it's an interesting thing for him to figure that out. Not everyone's going to do that. But when you ask him why he does it, he has a very good rationale and reason for why he does it, is that I need the sugar to wake me up. I don't like coffee. I don't actually like hot things. And, you know, he doesn't eat a lot of it, but a little bit is just what he needs to kind of perk him up and get him going in the morning in a way. And, you know, and he's very fit. He's a runner and this and that. So he's like, you know, this is kind of my way of rewarding myself before I have to go run. And when you kind of hear that narrative, you're like, you know, I would never have thought of coffee as an, I'm sorry, ice cream as a coffee substitute. But that's what these super consumers are, is that they're not just, my research has shown that the people that spend the most, they're actually the people who are the smartest people in the category, and they figured out alternative uses for the category that make their lives exponentially better, and that in a way, when other people hear about it, they're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Maybe I should try that as well, too. And so that, as when I started to see that pattern occur over and over again, I started writing with HBR, and that kind of turned into the book Super Consumers, which is really, I think, my attempt to try to democratize everything that I've learned about how to grow a business so that the most people can benefit from it, even if I'm not, you know, it doesn't benefit me directly as a consultant. And that's part of what I've been trying to do, especially when I left the Cambridge Group about 3 years ago to start Eddie Wood Grow, was I really thought I could help more people by writing about what I've learned than necessarily doing it myself. And that's why I wrote the book.
And that makes complete sense. And to go back to the ice cream, I just kind of shuddered when you said that, because I don't like sugar at all. I'm one of those little people who just doesn't like it. I don't like sweet foods unless it's sweet and sour sauce and it's, you know, got a pineapple in it and I'm dipping shrimp in it. Mm-hmm. Other than that, no. But I had a family member years ago, and I'd completely forgotten about this until you mentioned the breakfast, who was a terrible alcoholic. I mean, he eventually died of it. Mm. He would relapse and go back and forth. But when he was trying to give up alcohol, ice cream, he needed the sugar. And I just had this immediate flashback, and he went through tons of ice cream, and to this day I still shudder when I pass that. I was like, bleh. but it helped him. He managed, because I would ask, why are you having ice cream for breakfast and lunch and dinner? And, you know, every time I see you, you've got ice cream in your hand. And it did help him replace that sugar, apparently, from the alcohol.
Mm.
I would have never thought of that.
Well,
so I see what you're talking about. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's such a great story, right? Because I think it just shows the power of context being king, in that, you know, in a world where, I mean, you think about how much money and emotion is invested for people who are struggling with alcoholism, you know, be it treatment. And, you know, what if for some part of them, an answer was as simple as, you know what, just go have a scoop of ice cream instead. Like, Ed, maybe not forever, but as a temporary solution to get you to where you need to be with it. I mean, that's really interesting. Like, the thing I've heard a sub-story to that, Denise, is not as extreme, but like, so there are cracker super consumers, if you can believe it, you know, people who like saltines and Ritz crackers and, you know, Wheat Thins and things of that nature. And, you know, when you kind of dig underneath the surface, what is really quite fascinating is that these are people who are using crackers like Nicorette for chips, potato chips. And what
really?
They recognized in them, yeah, it was really quite fascinating. They were saying, you know what, I love potato chips. In part, I love the saltiness. I love the crunchiness. The snacking, you know, type thing is really important to me, but I got to stop and I got to slow down. And so what can I do to, you know, I can't quit cold turkey. So what they would do is they figured out that crackers gave them kind of 85% of what they were looking for, the saltiness, the crunchiness, But if you,
the
this
habit,
is going to sound
like
kind of weird.
The cigarette habit, something, you know,
yeah,
from...
It mimics
yeah,
the hand
because to me,
mouth.
A lot of... I've observed that smoking is something I've also never done, largely because I don't understand the logic of putting something on fire in your mouth and sucking into your lungs. It's not logical. I just don't get
yeah.
it.
But I
have observed that many smokers, for them, it's just that hand-to-mouth kind of habit, isn't it?
Yes.
Interesting.
And I think you nailed it right there. And what they would describe is, it kind of gives them enough to compensate. But there's a food science word called bolus, which is basically when you consume a cracker and you're chewing it, it forms what's called a bolus, which is it rather than dissolving right away like a potato chip does, you know, it forms a mass in your mouth that you have to chew through.
It's a glue.
And
yeah, it turns into a ball of glue.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so just what it does, it slows you down because you cannot consume crackers nearly as fast as you can with potato chips. And therefore, even though it seems like, well, are you trading one thing for another one, you end up coming out better for it as a result. And no one had ever really thought about crackers as Nicorette for potato chips, but until a super consumer cracked the code on it.
I'll be darned. See, and I would not have thought of that either, although I do like crackers, but I tend to do, you know, like once every 6 months I – you know, buy a box of saltines and then I fight the cats for it because they like them too, apparently. But yeah, but I would have never thought to make that distinction. So how are they, I guess my question is, how are they, you're tracking the super these consumers, I guess, and you're finding out that this is now replacing this. So it's not just a, hey, you know, this might work. It's actual science or research,
yes.
I guess. Interesting.
Well, and it's science and research and data coupled with, funny you mentioned cats. I have two cats, and you know the curiosity from a cat is really what you need, right? And that kind of doggedness of just kind of batting at it and trying to figure out why. And I think what you're getting at is you've kind of laid out the exact process, Denise, which is to say, you know, you find some kind of quote unquote anomaly in the data. Like, why is this really high and why is this really low? And oftentimes what I'll say to business leaders is that the one or two words that I hate the most in business is average or national average. Because people think averages are good because it takes a lot of data and boils it down to something simple. And I actually believe averages are terrible because it takes all the great nooks and crannies of data, the anomalies that are actually the most insightful and, you know, mashes them into peanut butter spread that so you never really understand what the heck is actually going on. And that when you find the anomaly, either something that spikes really high or something that spikes really low, and then you dig into it with the curiosity of a cat, then you discover that people, you know, in general, very, very rational and make very logical decisions in what people just hadn't thought of, that human beings are naturally creative problem solvers. And if you can have the empathy to not dismiss a behavior as weird, but as that's unusual, let me learn something about it, then, you know, surprise, surprise, you learn something from it.
I think you're really a scientist. You have a scientist soul, don't you?
Well, I think my brother, who is an actual aerospace engineer, probably would disagree. I think that's what I would aspire to. I'm a consumer scientist and a category scientist, and in the sense of I'm trying to look for observations, trying to form theories, and trying to prove them out in the real world so that they can help other people. So that if that is what makes me a scientist, then I think I would be guilty as charged.
Anybody who's looking for anomalies has got a scientist somewhere in their heart and soul, I'm telling you. So this is actually really fascinating because I will look at things, toilet paper, what the heck? Why? And I don't watch TV. I cut cable years ago. We all need it. We know we're going to buy toilet paper. But I do remember that every other commercial was about toilet paper. What is so special about one particular brand? Why can't you just go poke it in the, you know, you're standing there poking it. Okay, I like that one. Take it home with you. My question, and you may or may not know the answer to this, but it's always bugged me, are why are there is so much advertising revenue spent on something that we all use every day? What the heck is that about?
it's a great question, and I think to your earlier comment about scientists, I think most business leaders would benefit from more of that "what the heck is that about" attitude and mindset. And so when you ask it about toilet paper, there's a couple of things going on. One is that toilet paper is part, the more advertising that you see about something in general, it's a sign that it's not that one company's toilet paper is not that different from the other, so they have to shout louder at you. It's almost like, you know, you have a any kind of a family dynamic when there's a disagreement about something, and the mistake about raising your voice doesn't, you think it's going to help you, and it doesn't really. It kind of makes things worse. And so the more advertising that I see in general, the more I'm inclined to believe that you don't know how to improve your product, and you'd rather spend your money shouting at consumers. And you kind of make the assumption that people aren't that smart, and that the louder you shout at them, the more that is going to happen with it. But that's kind of an aside.
I agree with you, and I get the same way. It's like, you know, I like your product. I've always liked your product, but quit treating me like I'm a moron.
Yes.
Just stop.
Yes.
And that kind of leads me into one of the questions that I had for you, because we were talking earlier during the pre-call, and you had mentioned that 1%, which kind of surprised me, 1% of brands capture 80% of category growth. And let's talk about toilet paper since we're already here. I mean, are they the ones that are putting out the most money in terms of advertising dollars? Are they the ones that are actually making something a little bit different? Like, okay, this is puffier, it's softer, your cats are going to like it. You know, because cats love toilet paper. What is it with me and cats today? They love toilet paper too. Crackers and toilet paper. I'm going to have to go baby-proof my house when we're through here. But
right.
Yeah. I find that unless something is really very, very different from the last time I bought it, I'm just going to go right back to the brand I already bought and, you know, just kind of keep doing the same thing over and over again. So how, I guess my real question here is how they capture 80% of that category growth. I mean, what are they doing that is actually working for them? And if it's working for them, how can we do it as well, I guess, is another question.
Yeah, and I think you hit upon it at a couple of levels. Is one, the companies that are capturing category growth, that 1% that capture 80%, in general, they are doing something different, not better, and or cheaper. So most companies, if you were to take a step back, the vast majority of their strategies and tactics and investments are on making things quote unquote better or cheaper. But rarely do they actually spend the time to make it different. And there's a reason why for that. And that the reason that is at the core of it is what you alluded to, is that, you know, and again, this is going to sound harsh, but I've seen this across some of the best and biggest companies out there, is that I would say the vast majority of business executives assume that their consumers are not morons, but more moron-like than super consumer smart. And what they believe is that you're not paying attention, that I can, you know, if and all that you really care about is making it a little bit cheaper, or if I can make it 15% better, then maybe that'll be enough for you to buy. And like I always kind of describe what they do is going for extra credit on a pass-fail exam, right? Like it's not a very good use of time. Like what are you doing? Like who cares if it's 15% better? If it gets the job done in either scenario, then what should it matter? Whereas what they should be doing is looking at the super consumers, as you said. Like so again, take toilet paper as the example. We'll stay with this one. If you asked an average consumer for toilet paper, what would need to be true for you to spend 2 to 3 times as much on toilet paper or pay a 2 to 3 times higher price, they would just look at you blankly or laugh at you and say, that's ridiculous. Whereas a super consumer of toilet paper, somebody who cares quite deeply about it for a wide variety of reasons, would absolutely be able to answer if you made it X, Y, and Z. And it could range from, you know what, I would pay 2 to 3 times more if I didn't have to lug it around from the shopping supermarket through my car to my house, because when I have to load up toilet paper in my cart, that means that there's other things that I can't put in there, right? And that simple little thing could be the difference maker. Or it could be that I really want it to be that much better and softer as a result, because, you know, maybe there's some other you know, a skin, if maybe you have eczema, maybe you have some other skin condition that requires a softer touch on that front. Or it could be that I'm using it for completely other use cases than on the toilet and the like. And that, you know, and for all I know, there are people who are toilet super consumers that are using it as playthings for their cats, or they use it for a wide variety of other things that are meeting their needs in a way. And when this discussion, these are all things that are different. And the reason why different matters is what you're doing is the what I call the algebra of growing the category is actually fairly simple. Can you bring in new people into the category? Can you increase the uses per person? Or can you increase the price per use or unit? You know, so more people, more uses, more and usage occasions, and more and a higher price. If you can solve for making your product, your service different in a way that is attractive and results in one of those threes or more of those threes going up, then you're going to make the category bigger and you're going to capture 80% of that upside.
You know, and I hate to keep – this is going to be known as the toilet paper podcast, I'm afraid, and I hate to keep doing this. But not too long ago, I was in – we have a local grocery store here that is just wonderful. It's locally sourced. And we buy our shrimp directly from the Gulf. It's wonderful. And they had this massive sale on Charmin toilet paper, and I just stood back and watched it because nobody knew how to explain it. They had 6 or 7 different types, and it looked like it was a cheap, you know, good price. It was 96 rolls. It was 36 rolls. It was 72. What? And nobody could explain it. And people, consumers, were standing around these big containers of Charmin and saying, well, which is the best one? I don't know. What's the difference between 96 and 72? I don't know. Then they would go to the grocery checkout who really didn't know. I'm one of those people. I know exactly where this stuff is in the grocery store. I go in with my list. I go out. I don't enjoy it. It's not fun. I want to go home. I actually stood around and watched my fellow man try to figure out what the heck was different about the same brand of Charmin toilet paper. And they could only buy 2 rolls. It was, you know, that was limited. So that really caused some angst. And I remember thinking, there's got to be a lesson here. To this day, I don't know what it is, but I think you just explained what one of the big problems there that maybe the manufacturers don't know anything about is you better be able to explain in one sentence or less what the difference is. And if you can't do that, people are just going to go, I'll just grab the 2 on the end, and I'll probably go back to my regular product as soon as I'm done with this.
Yep.
Am I right or am I wrong?
You are 100% right. And I remember there's a gentleman by the name of Michael Fox. He's a former Frito-Lay executive and was a senior executive at Safeway running their private label business. And he's gone on to run a couple of other very successful businesses. But he would always say when he launched a new product at Safeway, because it was a private label brand, that you had to look at it and understand what was different and awesome about it and a good value for the price in 30 seconds or less. Otherwise, people, you move on to your point.
They probably should have ordered pizza and had coffee. They were really wanting to know what the difference was. And there was a little coffee unit, so I went over and I started asking people, does anybody want coffee? Because I'm just fascinated. So I was going over to the little free coffee pump and bringing over coffee and just kind of causing a little bit of a ruckus because I found it fascinating. It was just toilet paper. One was blue, one was pink, one, you know, different colors. Nobody knew what the heck the differences were.
Yep.
Still to this day, I don't know.
And you know what's so sad about this is that you know, the big manufacturers of the toilet paper, Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble and, you know, others and the like, you know, these are companies that have pretty significant interests in personal care and healthcare writ large. Like Kimberly-Clark has a very large healthcare business. And, you know, if you wanted to, if you cannot explain why your toilet paper is different or not, then I would say, you know, you think about all the people that you know. And so I've known a good friend of mine had colon cancer recently, right? And obviously, you know, that's a big leap to go from toilet paper to colon cancer. But what it really highlighted for me was
not really
the importance of GI and yeah,
right,
and your diet and the role that the massive role that it plays in your life. And, you know, partly I'm sure toilet paper innovation doesn't happen because people don't want to talk about it. But then when there are people who are very proactive about their health, and you know what, if it was like, you know, hey, this toilet paper has special coating, it does the job that it's supposed to do. But the moment that you have anything that you should be worried about from a GI, it's going to turn this color, right? And that means call your doctor right away. Because my friend who had colon cancer, you know, it was one of these things where she was ignoring the signs, right? Because, and oftentimes this happens when it comes to healthcare, is that you have a sneaking suspicion and you're not sure, but the reality of what it could be is so scary, you tend to just mitigate and ignore these things and stuff, right? Versus, you know, if a toilet paper could predict, you know, and even if it was better safe than sorry, right? Call your doctor now. Toilet paper would fly off, you know, we just explained that in 5 seconds, right? This toilet
exactly
paper does the job, but it tells you to call your doctor right now if you have a problem. Or it says, you know what, did you change your diet? Because this is not working the way it should, right? And so my youngest son was born with hypotonia. It's called basically low muscle tone. And, you know, when you have a baby, the thing that you care about the most is the baby eating and the baby pooping and peeing, right? Like the GI system is or is not working is really, really important. And, you know,
yeah, and you're definitely in charge of that. So you have to pay attention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to be paying attention. And that, you know, as a parent, like thankfully my wife is a nurse and so she handles all the healthcare stuff in our household. But like if it was me by myself or my wife wasn't a nurse, I would have no clue. And toilet paper that would be like, hey, you know, warning sign if your kids, for your kids, and if you don't know any better, these are the things that you got to watch out for. Call a doctor about this or that. Like that's really important. Like I have another friend who's working on a startup on a smart toilet that, you know, based on, you know, the contents of your urine can help predict if you're going to have a kidney problem or not with it and stuff. And you know, you think about all the innovation that comes in, you know, the massive amount of money that is spent on our healthcare system and the innovation opportunity for you to spot an issue before it happens or even adjust your diet. Like there's no shortage of innovation opportunities that exist. It's just a shortage of A, people wanting to take that risk or the seeming risk that's there, or B, you know, treating people like, as you said, they're more like morons than they are smart super consumers, and that people will never pay a premium for other things, and therefore we just have to make it 96 or 180 rolls. Like, let's just make it bigger.
Right. I just found the whole thing bizarre. A lot about it I find just bizarre, but watching the consumers scratching their heads and genuinely, one lady actually pulled out a calculator and she was reading. She wanted to know. And of course, I wanted to know too, so I went and got her a cup of coffee. But yeah, we were trying to figure out, or she was, I was just observing because I found the whole thing fascinating. It was $3 a package, which I guess is cheap. I don't know. But I mean, this area, they had cleared out this whole end cap area and just put, you know, these massive towers of this stuff, and there were boxes of it. It was a big deal, and nobody could figure out what it was all about. Why was it this price? Which was better? And I'm thinking, it's just toilet paper. Grab the two on the end cap. Let's go. Come on.
Yeah.
Let's go. But they genuinely wanted to know, and I found it very sad that the makers, or the marketers rather, not the makers, the marketers of this product didn't know better. They didn't make it easy.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have been that difficult.
Well,
it should not have been. So if anybody's
listening, you know what's interesting?
If you pay attention to how your consumers are going, what the heck is this?
Well, you know what? What at the end of the day, what I do have empathy for is that there are some business executives that I always say it comes down to your horizon, right? Like if you are, call it 3 years away from retirement, then your incentive to not rock the boat is pretty high. Like you just don't want to get fired or lose on your options, and let's just do incremental things and push paper around until I can ride off to the sunset. Whereas people who are trying to make a mark or trying to, you know, I always call them missionaries versus mercenaries, right? Where it's not just, you know, obviously that everybody wants their career to be successful, but they are trying to solve a broader problem or make an opportunity come to fruition that is, it's almost like they're going to try to get into the Hall of Fame, even though that doesn't really exist, even though I think it should with it. But one of the other things, there's another book I'm working on right now with a couple of friends, Christopher Lockett and Nicholas Cole, called What is Category Creation? And this idea of how do you create a new category? And in the same way that coffee has been around for hundreds of years, and then but you have Maxwell House, and you have Keurig, and you have Starbucks, and you have Nespresso, and those brands are not substitutable with each other, right? Like if you said, let's go get a Starbucks, and I said, oh, let me give you Maxwell House instead, you'd be like, that doesn't compute, right? Even though they're all coffee, and that what we
but
just
illustrated brands,
is that
they're brands, aren't they, more than anything?
They're
basically
well,
brands.
You know,
they're just coffee.
They're
I
brands,
say that
but they're
not coffee
also,
drinker, so if I offended anybody, it's just coffee.
No.
To me, it's just coffee.
This is a really good discussion, actually, as a non-coffee drinker, because, you know, what you might be surprised is that Starbucks sells, I think, at one count, it was 9 times more milk than they do coffee.
You're kidding.
No. Nobody realizes
that. And I just read somewhere yesterday, I think it's one of the biggest dairy producers in the country is facing bankruptcy because people aren't buying milk.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. We need to solve this.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going, Eddie.
Yeah. No, but this is, I mean, the ripple effects are always fascinating. But like Starbucks sells, you know, as much, if not more milk than they do coffee. And you think about what is in there are people who drink drip coffee, kind of like black coffee, but most people put something in their coffee. And then the most people who go to Starbucks, they're ordering a latte, which is a lot more milk than it actually is coffee. And, you know, Starbucks, you know, you think of at first blush as a coffee company, but it's really a milkshake company is the way I would describe it, because what people are getting are sweet milk drinks with a little bit of coffee in it, and that's what people buy, by and large, with it. The other thing that you might be surprised to know about Starbucks is that at any given time, they have more than $1 billion of cash loaded on the app for Starbucks. And if
oh,
I told you –
You're kidding me. A billion?
No. $1 billion or more. And these are people who are using the Starbucks app, so they're not using credit cards to pay for or cash or whatever. They just show the app, they get scanned and get out. And it is, you put $25 at a time or $50 or whatever, but then it is an interest-free loan that consumers are effectively giving to Starbucks for a so-so loyalty program and a slightly different way of paying for it. And in part, it's the power of the experience with it, and that at one point, Starbucks made over $100 million of profit off the float of managing this interest-free loan. So they can take the money in, and they can invest it in treasuries or something else that earns interest on it so that they get the benefit of that, and that Starbucks is effectively – not only is it not a coffee company, more so than a milk company, it's actually a good-sized regional bank with it. And that's what I mean by category creation, is that they sell a great product, but they have a business model that is radically different. And this is to your point about, like, unlike the toilet paper brands that can't explain themselves from one to the other, Starbucks, you can easily explain, is like, well, you can get coffee anywhere, but it is the experience, that third place that Howard Schultz talks about, why their locations are, you know, elaborate and free Wi-Fi and this and that. But and then you think about, well, how does it make money? Yep, they make money off the drinks, but they also make money off the float from the bank that they get. And they make money off the fact that they're selling you dairy, but they're charging you coffee prices and charging you a premium for better coffee, even though it accounts for a fraction of the volume that they're actually selling you. And so it's a really clever way.
I would have never, clever doesn't even describe it. That is brilliant. And I'm not a coffee drinker, but when I'm in Seattle, guess where I go? You got to. It's the experience.
Mm-hmm.
You must go to Starbucks. Any of them.
Yes.
And they're everywhere. You can't throw a stick without a Starbucks in Seattle.
Right.
But you have to do it.
Absolutely. And that's my whole point of, like, if you can do this in coffee, which is a commodity, right? And you create this kind of transformational experience that's radically different. Like, those two things are, if I thought about, a simple way of describing what a new category is it's the same, but it's radically different, and it gives you a transformational outcome. And that we talked about being radically different, right? Like, if you imagine a toilet paper that would say, it's toilet paper, but it's going to change color if it identifies that you have some sort of a GI issue that you should call a doctor about, right? That would be radically different, that you can explain in 30 seconds or less as we described. But the transformational outcome, what I fundamentally believe is that you talked about milk companies, the largest dairy going out of business, is that, if you are a product or a brand or a category, and you cannot explain how you transform a consumer's life in an outcome that is meaningful to them, then you're probably going to go out of business over the long haul, like this dairy company, the dairy producer is. And the same thing about toilet paper. Like, toilet paper brands that cannot explain not only why they are different, but you get an outcome. You obviously you're clean after going to the bathroom and this and that. But if it doesn't transform your life, even in a small way, then you're not going to survive in the long haul, and you're not going to reap the benefits of being a category creator. And Denise, I'll give you another example that's kind of funny. So take Velveeta as a brand, right? The cheese. Yeah, they actually call them loaves of Velveeta. And
it's
the
stuff. I cook with it. It's not even close to cheese. So they're lying to you straight out of the chute. But if you want to cook with something, make a casserole, get yourself a block of this stuff. It's wonderful.
Absolutely.
You can't eat it all by itself, so it's not edible.
Right. So imagine what you just described. Can't eat it by itself. It's not edible. It is a block of cheese. It doesn't have to be refrigerated. It is not organic and natural. So it's just not on trend, quote unquote. And yet, one of the things that the brand has done that's been very fascinating is that, so the average consumer, if you ask them, would you like to buy more Velveeta? Not a hands go up unless you're already buying it. Now, when you ask a Velveeta super consumer, why do you buy? So a Velveeta super consumer buys 9 of these a year, whereas most people don't even buy one. The people who buy it tend to buy one a year for Super Bowl parties to make queso or a casserole or something like that. What the Velveeta super consumer has figured out is that, this is my Trojan horse way of getting my children to eat vegetables. And you're like, well, what does that mean? And
broccoli.
If I were to...
You can't have broccoli without cheese, right? Cauliflower, all of it.
You took the words right out of my mouth. And,
broccoli casserole, Christmas is coming.
And with Velveeta, that sounds amazing. And that's the whole point. Is that
and cream
you
of
can
mushrooms
have broccoli.
Too.
Cream of mushroom. Oh, now I'm getting hungry. It's too early for me.
I've got the recipe. I'll send it to you.
Absolutely. But you take broccoli and you put shredded cheese on it, then, that's doesn't work. It doesn't get into whereas Velveeta gets into every nook and cranny of the broccoli stalk. And the net effect, as you're describing broccoli casserole, the net effect of it is that parents will say, when I use Velveeta, the kids who won't eat vegetables now eat vegetables. And so that is what I'm describing is it's not, you don't have to solve for cancer prevention, but if you've ever, been around the picky children and the stress that creates, and you want your kids to eat vegetables, getting them to do so, that is a transformational outcome. And that when you ask consumers the question, do you want more Velveeta? Not as many hands go up, but if you ask parents, would you like your children to eat more vegetables? Many more hands go up because that's the transformational outcome. That this, as you said, it's not edible by itself. Block of shelf-stable cheese just sold in the center of a store delivers that. That is something that most brands or categories don't know how to articulate. Not only what makes you different, and do you deliver a transformational outcome if I use it? And unless you can articulate those two things, your business over the long haul probably won't survive.
And see, I was thinking about that when you're talking about that, and I like Velveeta, but I cook with it. You can't just eat. If you put even a small mm-hmm. bit of that in your mouth without a cracker or as a toasted cheese, you're going to have to scrape it off your tongue. It just doesn't
yes.
work that way. It's gluey. It doesn't really taste all that wonderful unless you add it to other things. So now you've taken it and you've transformed it into recipes and sandwiches and, you know, just all kinds of really tasty things. Look, I make a chicken enchilada soup that is to die for, and I use Velveeta cheese in it because cheddar is greasy.
Mm.
So, you know, the,
yes.
there's just so many different things that you can do. So you can make you can take that argument and say, well, a lot of cheddars, as much as wonderful as they are, they do leave a lot of grease in the dish. Velveeta doesn't. So, you know, there's just, once you pick apart your product and you know, your marketing people know, everybody knows exactly what it does and what it doesn't do, then you start explaining it to people, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And what I love about what you just described, Denise, is that the greasiness of cheddar is true regardless of the quality of the cheddar, right?
Exactly.
You can buy the best cheddar from the most, you know, the most expensive cheddar from the highest, most falutin producer or brand in the world. It does not, it is still going to be greasy. And what the Velveeta folks have figured out is that, you know what? We provide the best melt. And when you provide that.
There it is. That's what I was looking for, the melt. Exactly. I was digging in my head, couldn't find it.
Well, that's the part that I think is so brilliant, is that if Velveeta can figure out we're the best melt. And you know what? We're not the leading actor. We're the supporting actor. We go better with something else. And that's the part that a lot of brands and business people have a really hard time with, is that they want to be the leading star, whereas sometimes if you recognize the fact that you are better off and you deliver better outcomes for the consumer as a supporting cast member, then you're actually going to be more successful as a result. But ego, as always, gets in the way. And that's the part that I think has been interesting for me.
It is. It's fascinating. And, you know, when we first started this talk, I really didn't understand what categories were. And I like to think on most days, except Fridays, I'm a fairly intelligent person, but I could not grasp what you meant by categories. And now I've got it. I mean, I completely understand it. So I'm finding this absolutely fascinating. So basically, what you're saying, too, and I've heard you say this, is every category has untapped growth of 20% or more. And I'm trying to
yep.
figure out, you know, we're talking about foodstuffs and we're talking about, you know, healthcare and all kinds of different things. Do you have some categories that you can, you know, just kind of toss out that we could play with? That, you know, they have
sure.
in Tapco. I mean, I get the Starbucks. I do, because if I'm not
yep.
wrong, they started out as just, they touted themselves as the best tasting coffee bean.
Mm-hmm.
I don't drink coffee, so it's, well, I rarely drink coffee. To me, it all tastes like crankcase oil, so I'm not going to be that person. But
yeah.
I'm assuming for a lot of – and then once they and correct me if I'm wrong, once they started serving up these, you know, these great cups of coffee and started adding, which is something all brands should do, you know, add, make it an experience, mm-hmm. Add something more, until, you know, you've got enough people going, oh, this is terrific. But here's something that bothers me a bit. I think that sometimes brands get too top-heavy with all their additions, and they lose sight of what they really started. So
yeah.
where is – and I got away from my original question there. We'll go back to it. But where do people or brands or companies say, you know what, we might have gotten a little overexcited here. Let's scale it back to what people really know and really like and really want to buy. So do you see that happening too, that kind of going, we went too far?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it happens, I think, I'm trying to think of a good example where, and actually, I think going too far is generally speaking a good thing, because, like, you don't know where your limits are until you push past them. And that too many businesses they're afraid to even try and to see if it'll work at all with it. But, you know, like I'm trying to think of there's always good examples of overreach out there with it. So take Nike as a brand, right? They tried to push into golf, and they were successful for a while. They had that iconic moment when I think it was Tiger Woods was almost about to hit the shot where the ball is rolling slowly, slowly, and it hits the edge of the lip of the cup, and you can see the Nike logo on it, and then it falls in. It's a very dramatic moment. And despite all of that, I believe they pulled out of golf in a way because, you know what, we're kind of shoes and we're kind of running, and it became hard to say why are my golf balls any different than somebody else's golf balls, right? And that was something that I think was an example of, like, you know what, let us use our super consumer as a barometer to see how far we can go and how far we shouldn't go with it. And I think that's and what you've seen is that, you know, they've really kind of backed into where their legacy and their strength is around shoes. You know, they've recently stopped. They said, we're not going to sell to Amazon anymore because we actually, we believe in our own e-commerce business. But I believe they launched a shoe subscription service for kids where, because buying shoes for growing children is a really frustrating experience because they outgrow them so quickly. And so I believe they've tried to solve for this with a subscription service that allows you to trade in shoes and go back and forth with that. Like, that's a really clever business model. And that's,
that makes
again,
sense.
Radically different than transformation outcome. And, and this goes
I
back
heard
to
of
the
it,
point
but I like
of,
it.
Yeah, well, and it's I just saw another one where they launched a Nike shoe for hospital employees, like basically people like when my wife was working 12-hour shifts. If you're spending 12 hours plus on your feet, right, you're not running, but you need different foot support in a way that's going to help you endure that really painful, work experience. And that they've identified a set of people for whom there was an unmet need. Again, that is much closer to their core business and stuff. And so,
and people like that
point.
Are working on concrete floors, which is really tough on you.
Yes, yes.
So that's got to
be
a whole different set of specs for those shoes, I would think.
Yes. And so I think that's the it's a really good one of saying, your super consumers are the North Star. They can take you, lead you to risks that you might not have considered, but they can also help you recenter and say, that was a little bit of hubris. I went too far. Let's go back to the core, because they're always going to have ideas for how do you make your core business better and attract new people into the franchise or charge more for it, frankly.
Gotcha. So basically, and let's go back just for a quick minute, every category has an untapped growth of 20% or more, and you were going to give us some examples before my brain took off and my mouth loaded and just said, okay, let's talk about this instead.
Yeah, so I'll give you one. There's a company called Hydrafacial. I don't know if... It's an up-and-coming company based in Long Beach, California, and what they create these delivery systems, which is basically if you've ever had a regular facial, you go to the spa, and then there's an esthetician that is like, kind of does a little bit of pampering. They squeeze the blackheads out of your face, which is kind of gross, but it's a manual extraction process. It's kind of painful as well too, right? Because they're pinching your skin. And then they kind of moisturize, and then you're off. And then, it's thought of as like this pampering thing, but not a treatment. Like, you don't actually – it's nice to have those blackheads squeezed out of your face, but you don't actually – it doesn't really make a difference in your face over the long haul, right? Hydrafacial is a technology that almost like a dental assistant's suction tube, where there's a wand that's connected to a machine, a delivery system that goes over your face and using technology extracts the dirt, the gunk, the dead skin, whiteheads and blackheads out of your face. And that through that same wand, when it's extracted all of that stuff, immediately hydrates your face with, you know, nutrients and things that are going to help your face and your skin be better. And what the, so it's a radically different experience because it's not somebody's hands pinching your face. It's just, this technology is actually a more pleasant way of extracting all the gunk out of your face. It's also radically different because the gunk goes into a little vial that they show you after the fact, and it's disgusting. And yet it's very strangely satisfying to say, wait, that was in my face? I'm kind of weirdly obsessed by looking at it to say, I am so glad it's not in my face. It's kind of gross, but, you know, I'm thankful for this. And it delivers a transformational outcome because what ends up happening is because the process is so much more effective than the normal facial, and because the beauty category in general is hope in a bottle. It's a lot of lotions and potions that promise a lot but don't actually do much. And that what consumers who've had a hydrofacial will say is, you know what, I get my hydrofacial and I go to work, and random kind of clueless guys like me will say, what's up with your face? It's glowing. You know, my girlfriends or family members will say, you have a glow about your face that lasts for days, if not a week or longer with it. And, you know, this idea that your face is literally transformed and glowing because it's extracted all this gunk that you can see, so that you know it works, and it hydrates your face. That this business is on fire, and in a facial category where, you know, it's kind of been a stodgy one because it's like, you know, basically mostly women partake of the traditional facial category. You go as grooves. It's a little bit of an occasional treat and a pampering thing versus a hydrofacial where people are getting them on the regular, sometimes monthly, because they like the transformational outcome, that it's a wide range of consumers. Like I remember we talked to one fast food worker, so not someone not on the high end of the income scale, but was basically saying, you know what, I love this hydrofacial so much. Sometimes I think about, am I going to go out this weekend or get my hydrofacial instead? And that's the trade-off that they're making. And the third one is that guys are getting these as well. A lot of the younger consumers coming in are guys because – guess what? This process takes 30 minutes. I can get in and out. I don't have to disrobe. I can just do this. And then, you know, whether it's for, I just want to, you know, look good for myself, or maybe I'm going on a date, but a lot of the times is I'm going to go on a job interview. And you know what? This hydrofacial might help me get a job that I really want and stuff. So it's a professional expense. And so you think about the levers that I mentioned beforehand, they are bringing new consumers into the category. You know, men, you know, lower income people of all demographics, they are getting them more frequently because the thing actually works, right? and they're charging higher prices for it in a way that has allowed an esthetician who's working in a spa or dermatologist to make more money. And so not only is it helping the consumer, it's helping the employees as well, because, you know, a regular facial might have taken an hour. This takes 30 minutes. I can do more of these. I can charge more for it, or there's a wide range of things. And so everybody wins in this scenario, Denise. And it's this amazing thing where, you know, this combination of a breakthrough product with a breakthrough business model, because it's delivered through technology and estheticians and serums. But because they follow the playbook of category creation, you know, it's radically different. It's a transformational outcome, and if you can do those things, then you're going to be successful in a way that other people aren't. And they're growing the number of people in the category of facials writ large in a significant way, probably going to be much larger than a 20% uptick there.
I wonder if plastic surgeons are going to be including this in part of their suite of, you know, offerings. I mean, that would make sense,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are absolutely. So what's fascinating is that the companies that are buying these hydrofacial delivery systems, you know, spas, of course, medical spas, dermatologists, plastic surgeons, as you were describing, because, you know, they view it as, you know, hey, maybe if you get this, you see that it works, you know, you might want to try another service that we offer that maybe you were not willing to consider.
Right.
But, you know, there's that angle of it. Fitness clubs, gyms are including these, which is kind of
I would not
really
have thought of that.
Yep. Because, you know, it's like, why work on your physical fitness and, you know, and why not go all the way and get your face to be its best that it can be as well, too, right? I mean, that's the whole mindset. You're going to get more of those guys that I mentioned beforehand. But, like, this whole – and actually what's interesting is in parts of Asia, these machines, these delivery systems are being installed in dental offices, if you can believe that.
Dental offices.
Yeah,
well, that makes
sense. That's
I mean, you're already there.
Had.
If you had a brain, you didn't go with a face full of makeup to your dentist. I mean, you just don't any more than you go to your ophthalmologist with eye makeup on. So that makes sense. You're already kind of stripped bare anyway. You're already there. You might as well extend it, you know, get your teeth cleaned and do that. That makes perfect sense.
Yes. Well, and as you said, like you think about the dentist, there's regular kind of dentists, and then there's cosmetic dentistry, right? And one of the things I wrote in my book, my first book, Super Consumers, is that if you're a super consumer of one category, you tend to be a super of nine others, some of which are obvious and some of which are not. But if you're there to get cosmetic dentistry, to get your teeth whitened, as an example, why wouldn't you want your whole face to glow? And that was an aha. Like, no one would have ever thought, like, oh, dentistry is an interesting way to getting into hydrofacial consumers. But when you take a step back, it makes perfect sense. Why would you want, you know, if you're going to want your feet, your teeth to glow, be brighter, wouldn't you want your face and vice versa? And then it becomes this inner, to your point about the plastic surgeon, it becomes this virtuous cycle of I can get more people to come in to see what I have to offer, whether it's through their teeth or their face. And guess what? Once they get one, they're probably going to want the other.
Wedding planners. I mean, they're always making recommendations.
Yep.
They could set up,
absolutely,
you know, some kind of reciprocal agreement with a lot of these places. I mean, it's really kind of wide open, isn't it?
Yes. And I love the wedding planner insight because I remember talking to, there was a mother of a bride that was getting these hydrofacials weekly, like months before her wedding day. And you're like, why are you spending this amount of money? It's like, because those wedding pictures will hopefully last forever, and I'm going to look the very best that I can for those photos, and it's completely worth it to me for that. And I'm like, oh, that makes total sense, right?
And I think people forget or either not aware or just don't care. I mean, we live on our skin. We know what our skin is doing. We forget, I think, that it's the biggest organ in our body.
Mm.
And it will often tell you what's going on inside your body. If you're yellowish, you know, you've got liver problems. If you're looking gray, you're either hungover or you're really sick. I mean, I pay a lot of attention to my skin because it kind of clues me into what's going on.
Yes.
So, yeah, I understand where they're going. This is fascinating. This really is. So, I mean, we could keep on going, but we're just about out of our hour. So basically what you're saying, Eddie, is a super consumer of one category is a super consumer of nine others. That's amazing.
Yes.
Do you have any examples? Can you just rattle some off?
Sure. So I work with a company called Generac. They make these standby generators. So when you have a bad northeasterly storm or a hurricane and your power goes out, you have one of these and you have temporary electricity right away. It's an expensive product category, so like $7,000 to $10,000 or more. So, and most people haven't really thought about it. So it's a really hard thing to sell. And then one of the things we noticed was there were people who were buying these generators without needing a power outage to prompt them. And we're kind of like, what's going on there? And it turns out those people, you can predict because they tend to be overinsured. They have 2 to 4 times more life insurance than they actually need. They have extra riders on their auto insurance policy. And we found, Denise, that they were super consumers of vitamins. Like they loved vitamins. They bought and consumed a ton of them. And we're like, what is going on here? Until we took a step back and said, you know what? The reason why you proactively buy a generator is you care about, you are proactive and you want protection. And the worst case scenario is something that you're very comfortable with and you want to get out ahead of. And that life insurance is exactly the same motivation. And that vitamins is exactly the same motivation too. I am willing to spend money and consume and take things on now for a benefit that may come down the road, but I don't actually know when or where. And that it was, ironically, if you could find somebody who is overinsured, they were great candidates for this generator, and the same thing for vitamins and whatnot there.
And see, again, that makes sense. I mean, you've spent a lot of money. Like, I have a generator. It's not a house generator. It's in my garage, and if I need it, we have a lot of hurricanes here. If I need it, I fire it up. Mostly because it's not that I'm uncomfortable without power. I've lived 5, 6, 7 days without power before. But the contents of my freezer, a lot of money in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things that we have in our homes. And I live in a very humid climate, very humid.
Mm-hmm.
My house will mold and nothing flat if I'm not careful.
Mm-hmm.
I kid you not. So, you know, you have, I think a lot of these people are saying, okay, but, you know, what about the money that I've already spent? What about the time and energy I've already spent? Will this protect that? And that may be part of their thinking as well.
Totally. Actually, to your point, people who are hunters realize quickly that the generators are the best thing for them because they hunt, they store and freeze meat. And when you ask somebody, is $7,000 for a generator expensive? Like, oh, yeah. Like, well, how much is in your refrigerator? Like, oh, exactly what you described. It's like, I hadn't thought about it. That might actually be a few thousand dollars. And then it's a much better investment. And so it became the whole thing of like, ask people how many refrigerators and freezers they have. And the more that they have, the easier it is to make the argument of an ROI. I mean, these are all the telltale signs that people don't think about until you actually get into the mindset of an actual super consumer with
it. Well, and then when you have to talk to your insurance agency and they say, well, throw it away. We can't replace it. We're not going to pay for it. Toss it. In my part of the country, when we know our power isn't coming back on for a while, we have a giant street barbecue. Everything comes out of the freezers and it gets cooked. So,
well,
you do what you got to do.
And it's funny when you get back to the emotion is so important to understand. To your point about the street barbecue, like we asked one guy, sometimes we'll do something called psychological drawings is where we have a super consumer, we get out a bunch of color pens and pencils and crayons, say, draw me somebody who bought a generator without needing one. And usually the adults look at us like cross-eyed and then they get into it. They're like, oh, I haven't drawn since I was in elementary school or whatever. And then this one guy draws a Superman figure, big muscles, standing on top of the Empire State Building with a cape, and we're like, what's going on there? And he was kind of sheepish, and he was like, you know what? I can't wait for the power to go out. And we're like, what are you talking about? He's like, because I have a generator, and because I know when the power goes out, I will be the only beacon on the hill, and all my neighbors will look at me and standing in line to cook their food and take showers. I'll have a glass of wine in one hand, and that my neighbors will know definitively that I am better than they are. And we're like, oh, okay, that was a lot.
He needed a big tip jar to go with that, too.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, this was the whole point. He wanted the credit for being proactive in that when you're proactive and you're trying to prevent stuff, you know, sometimes you seem like the lunatic in the neighborhood, and sometimes then when everything goes wrong, then you were the amazing, prescient, you know, smart guy on the block, and that's what he was looking for, that validation.
Exactly. He was stomping out fires before the fire showed up.
Yes.
Can't say I blame him. Eddie, thank you. We actually ran out of time. We're still recording, but anybody in the chat room lost us, but they can come back and listen in iTunes. But it has been absolutely fascinating speaking with you, and I thank you for all the wonderful tips and advice and the terrific stories that you shared with our audience. And I really want you, before I let you go, tell people where they can find you and where they can find your book.
For sure. You can find me. My website is www.eddiewoodgrow.com. So EddieWoodGrow.com. Or same thing on Twitter or on LinkedIn. You can find me there as well, too. You can, obviously, I have a couple of books. My book, Super Consumer, published by Harvard. Another book coming out, What is Category Creation? But the book that I really want people to get is my daughter Audrey's book, Joy, which you mentioned at the outset.
I have it.
It is a sixth grade English project that she wrote, and it is about a yellow balloon that comes to life and chases this workaholic dad and forces him to confront his addiction to work before he loses his family. And first thing I asked was, is this about Dad? And she's like, no, it's not about Dad. Of course, my friends are all like, well, who else could it be about? And one thing led to another. We got it published with a great illustrator. And, you know, people are like, why do you talk about this? It doesn't really make you look good. I'm like, well, you know, I went and left corporate America to run my own business. I called this my personal IPO because I freed myself from one shareholder and I had now many, and I love it. And thankfully, I did that a year before she wrote the book, so I can say with plausible deniability that one thing didn't lead to the other. I was ahead of the curve there. But if her book can help other working parents find that balance like I have, then all the more worthwhile. So of the three books that are out there, I'd say my daughter Audrey's book, Joy, is the most important one. So that's the one I would push people to get.
And do me a favor, tell her that I'm single. I will always be single for the rest of my life. That is just written in stone. Been married, did it, not going to do it again, done. But I am a workaholic, big time. And you know who I let down the most when I'm not paying attention? Me. And this book is very important for people like me who may not be parents. We may not have to, you know, talk with other people or explain why we're doing something, but we do have to explain it to ourselves. So this book is basically for everybody who is working too darn hard and not enjoying life enough. So tell her for me that it resonated with me as well.
I will absolutely pass it along. And that is, I think it's completely well said. It's very hard to know if you are working too much. And you need kind of a disruption from the outside. So
it is. And sometimes I have to sit myself down and say, Denise, I'm pointing my own finger at myself, Denise. Back off. You need to stop. You need to relax. Go outside. Go do something. But you're right, because we just get so caught up and so focused. And after a while, you know, a week has gone by and you had something you were really going to do that last week and it's still on your list. That you're working too hard.
Stop.
Take a break. Anyway, tell her I really appreciate having the book, and I think it's a wonderful book, and I hope people will grab it and really pay attention to it. So, Eddie, again, thank you. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and really anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you so much. It has been genuinely a pleasure.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.